From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
That book had been in my head for a number of years. My mother passed in 01, and I had been telling her about all these thoughts that were going through my mind. And she told me, she said, you may as well just go ahead and write it down. And so I finally decided after I retired completely that I just got my laptop and I just sat down in my study and I put pen to paper, or, you know, I hunt and picked it out with two fingers. And it took me about 2 years. The story had been in my head, but when I started putting it on paper, I realized that I was going to have to talk about all the different characters that were going to be in the story, and I had to literally create a background for each one of these characters.
Cleveland Pimpton, author of No One Left to Hate, published by Authorship Publishing. Can someone you've never met have an impact on your life? The answer is simply yes. No One Left to Hate is the story of two men who shared the same first name, but because of fate intervening, they never met. Separated by war and a generation apart, they both do their part to save the lives of their friends and brothers in arms. The spirit of one seems to live in the other. Shirley, the true one love of Malcolm and the mother of the other, is the conduit that connects them. The story is also about a journey one man takes. After losing the love of his life, he finds true happiness again and a second chance of having the family he hoped for. As a former police officer and now a minister in North Texas, Pimpton has penned a story that will touch you in ways you can't imagine. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, No One Left to Hate with author Cleveland Pimpton, In Black America.
The title was one of the main characters in the book named Hanger.
Right.
You know, he would always make comments that, you know, I hate they're doing this, I hate they're doing that. Not that he actually hated people. He just did not like what they were doing and felt that the way things were, the status quo was fine. Mm-hmm. But he would always make that comment about, I hate this or I hate that. And so his wife, Helen, would always tell him, well, you know, you really don't hate anybody. And so that was how I came up with the title, was that she would always tell him, you know, you don't hate anyone. You really don't hate anyone. And you should stop saying that. And so from there, that title just literally stuck in my head. And so that helped me formulate the story and how I wanted it to flow.
What happens when two men from two different worlds go off to war and find themselves depending on each other for their survival, and one gives their life for the other? This is one of the stories behind Cleveland Pimpton's No One Left to Hate. One man is commissioned into the U.S. Army, the other is drafted. They both are from the same town. As fate or coincidence would have it, their lives will be forever connected. The story is also about a renewed appreciation for life. After losing his wife and child while he was overseas, Charles W. Walker III thought he could never love again, let alone get married. Born and raised in Waco, Texas, Pimpton moved to Fort Worth at the age of 20. 6 months later, he joined the Fort Worth Police Department. He worked there as an officer for 6 years. Then he transferred to the DA's office as an investigator. In 1999, he was called into the ministry. No One Left to Hate is a book he has had in his mind for a number of years. After his mother passed in 2001, he decided to put pen to paper.
Well, the truth is, when I was at TCU and I met this guy. His name was Rodney, and he was an investigator. And he asked me, had I ever considered becoming a DA investigator? Well, I didn't want to tell him I didn't know what one was. So I went back and did a little research and found out exactly how the system operated. And it was just God's plan. After graduation, they called me and offered me a job, and I took it.
And how did you, and when did you become
part of the ministry? When you get to calling, I guess that's the term you use.
Well, I've been in law enforcement since 70.
Okay.
And in 1999, God pretty well laid me on my back for about 3 months.
Oh, okay.
And he dealt with me because I had been a deacon in my church for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that. I liked behind the scenes. But God had another plan, and he finally had to lay me down to stop me from running from him.
Okay.
So I accepted my call to the ministry in 99, and I've been going forward with it ever since.
Okay. You have an interesting book here, No One Left to Hate. Well, one, how'd you come up with the title, and what inspired you to write the book?
That book had been in my head for a number of years. My mother passed in 01,
mm-hmm.
and I had been telling her about all these thoughts that were going through my mind. And she told me, she said, you may as well just go ahead and write it down. And so I finally decided after I retired completely that I just got my laptop and I just sat down in my study and I put pen to paper or, you know, I hunt and picked it out with two fingers, and it took me about 2 years.
So during that two-year process, were you, you know, writing notes to yourself, or the stories were formulated in your head, and you jot down some ideas?
Definitely. The story had been in my head, but when I started putting it on paper, I realized that I was going to have to talk about all the different characters
mm-hmm.
that were going to be in the story, and I had to literally create a background for each one of these characters. And so never writing a book before, it took a little time for me to do that.
Interesting characters. How did you come up with the characters, and does any of the character resemble anyone in your life?
Well, yeah, one of the characters at the very beginning of the book, that character developed in my mind because one of my high school classmates joined the Marine Corps after graduating from high school.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then he went to Vietnam, and within 90 days, they shipped his body back.
Yeah, that happened to some of my classmates also.
Yeah, and so that was how that particular character at the beginning was formulated. But the character of the young man, Malcolm. That mm-hmm. Decides to join the police department
mm-hmm.
while he was going to college.
College, right.
That was me. I worked my way through college on the police department. And that was how I came up with that particular character, and some of the situations and the incidents he went through were actually some true incidents of things that I had to deal with
mm-hmm.
while I was on the police department.
Okay. How'd you come up with the title?
The title was one of the main characters in the book named Hanger.
Right.
You know, he would always make comments that, you know, I hate they're doing this, I hate they're doing that. Not that he actually hated people. He just did not like what they were doing and felt that the way things were, the status quo was fine.
Mm-hmm.
But he would always make that comment about, I hate this or I hate that. And so his wife, Helen, would always tell him, well, you know, you really don't hate anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was how I came up with the title, was that she would always tell him, you know, you don't hate anyone. You really don't hate anyone. And you should stop saying that. And so from there, that title just literally stuck in my head. And so that helped me formulate the story and how I wanted it to flow.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And today, believe it or not, we are doing this interview in a parking lot in the suburbs of Dallas in Arlington, Texas. And we're speaking with Reverend Cleveland Pimpton, author of the book, No One Left to Hate. Cleveland, when you formulated the characters in reading the book, And I guess a good writer does this, is they're so lifelike that when you read the different characters, someone comes to mind that, hey, either I know a person like that, or there's someone that's very familiar with me.
The one thing that I kind of came to understand about writing, as I was writing the story, I thought about individuals I knew.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And some of the stories or the things they had been through in life that mm-hmm. I knew about. And I realized that when writing a story, fiction or however, that it will you're telling somebody's, some story of somebody's life.
Life, right. Let's go through some of the chapters, and because we want people to buy the book, so we're not going to give you a complete synopsis of the book. In developing Thomas, I mean, he's gone away to Central State University. It opens up in that first chapter, and I assume it's like the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, so I'm assuming it's like late 50s, early 60s, they're marching, and he really don't understand, you know, why African Americans are upset by not being able to go certain places or do certain things.
Yeah, and over the years, I have met different white guys or mm-hmm. white people, and they just assumed that black people were or should have been happy
okay.
with the situation under which they
mm-hmm.
lived,
mm-hmm.
the status quo. And he just, in his mind, he could not understand why they felt it was necessary for them to go out and march to want to try and bring about some change. And so he would always make that statement, you know, I hate they're doing that. Why don't they just leave things alone? Everything is fine like it is.
It seems it's a common thread, and I don't know if this just been a part of your life. All the women in the book have been just intellectually superior. They hit it right, the nail on the head. Obviously, that's what you were attempting to do. And are there any of those individuals, you know, kin to your wife, your sister, your daughter, your mom, your grandma? I mean, it's just amazing how much insight Helen, Wanda, Shirley, all of them had, echoes of mom and dad. Inside of I guess you would call it intuitiveness.
Well, I was raised by one of the wisest women.
Okay.
My mother, I think she went to probably the eighth grade
mm-hmm.
in school because they were raised out in a rural area.
Okay.
But she was one of the wisest people that I've ever dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And it always amazed me how she had an understanding of people.
Mm-hmm.
And of life for never going any farther than she did in school.
Okay.
But she would tell me about things and situations, and she helped me to understand certain things that it just blew me away, because I'm thinking, well, you know, people go to school for 10 years
mm-hmm.
to be able to, you know, express this kind of knowledge. And for her, it was just there. Well, both my parents were.
Is that motherwit?
Motherwit.
They called it.
Yeah. And my wife, we actually, Sunday, tomorrow, is our 40th wedding anniversary.
Okay. Well, congratulations.
And she is one of those people, very quiet, very intellectual, mm-hmm. And she never has very much to say. But when she speaks... It pays to listen, because she's not just rambling. She expresses some real understanding of what's going on.
Okay. Let's talk about Malcolm Echoes. He's graduating. He's going to graduate. He gets the letter from the Army that he needs to be inducted. So he goes in, and obviously, because you skip forward, because when he meets Hager,
he's already
there, and he's basically made a name for himself because he's a sergeant, and he's bringing this. He's gonna basically, I guess, look over Lieutenant Hager when he joins that particular unit.
Right.
Why was the character Malcolm important to you? Obviously, if, when you read the book, it sets up everything else, but putting him that up front in the book.
Well, there's a little bit of him, of me in him.
Okay.
I'll put it like that. I was 21 years old when I joined the police department.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so I had guys of every race coming on behind me. And at that time, we didn't have what we call training officers.
Mm-hmm.
But they would put the new rookies with people who were already out there.
Okay.
So they would put guys with me for me to take them and teach them the ropes out on patrol.
True. Okay.
And they, some of them were 4 or 5, you know, years older than I was.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they want to know, are you old enough to be telling me anything? I say, well, you close the door and get in and close the door, and I'll show you what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of came from my experience of training people who were actually older than I was.
Okay. Now we get to the tragic death of Echols, because he saved the lieutenant, and the story evolves from there, because at the time Malcolm isn't married to Shirley, but Shirley is pregnant with little Malcolm.
Right.
How did you develop that twist?
Well, Malcolm asked Shirley to marry him.
Right, she wouldn't till after.
And she said, no, we're going to wait until you get back so we can have a proper wedding.
Right.
But because they loved each other, it's not actually written in the story, mm-hmm. but it's obvious that they decided that they would make love this one time before he mm-hmm. left going in service.
Right.
And so that story developed out of situations and people that I've known.
Okay. Now let's talk about Charles Walker. He's third generation military guy.
Right.
I mean, they have a tradition that has gone down through the ages. They're college educated. How did that character form?
Well, where I grew up, I didn't know very many college educated people, except for my teachers and the principal of the school.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, his character came about because of the history of his family that I created.
Okay.
His grandfather mm-hmm. fought in First World War.
Right.
And he did his job, and he came home to a hero's welcome, but then he was told, stay in your place.
Stay in your place, right.
And so he understood that he wasn't fighting just for himself, but he was fighting for a better day.
For his son
for
and son's
son.
For
his son and son's son, mm-hmm. for his descendants.
Right.
And so, and the same thing happened with his father. You know, it was like, I remember, in fact, my parents taking us to the polls with them.
Okay.
When mm-hmm. we were kids, they mm-hmm. would, when it was time to vote, we went to the polls with them, and they showed us, you know, how they voted and told us why they voted for this person or that person. But I also was told the story of how when my father came back from World War II, after being in Germany and Italy, how he could fight for the country, but he was not allowed to vote. And so that's how I developed those characters. In our family, my parents could not afford to send us to college. There were 8 of us,
mm-hmm.
so they couldn't afford to pay to send us to college, but they gave us every incentive in the world to go. So the police department had a program that helped pay for my education.
So that's where that came in. Okay.
So that's mm-hmm. where that part of it came in.
Okay. So Walker goes off, he gets commissioned, he's sent over to Vietnam, and he's doing quite well. I mean, he's doing quite well. He's staying out of harm's way. But then, just before he comes home, tragedy strikes him personally, and he uses the term, I hate. I mean, he hates the military. He's been in the military. He's been around the military all his life. But now he hates the military because the military didn't give him the respect when tragedy happened at home. They needed him there to do what he needed to do.
Yeah, well, he was always taught that service to his country was very important.
Foremost and important.
And so he was willing to give that time. Mm-hmm. But because of that war, he was away from his family when tragedy struck. And no one gave him the option to say, I need to get back home or stay where I am. Mm-hmm. You know, that decision was made for him. And like so many of us growing up in the 60s, there were decisions about, you know, where we could go to school. And it wasn't anything that we had a choice about.
It's something about in-laws. Certain things you can't talk to your parents about, but the in-laws seeing the big picture. The wife is gone, the child he had is gone, and they want Charles to move on.
Well, the love of his life, all his hopes and dreams have gone in the ground.
Exactly.
And so he really doesn't feel like he has a whole lot to live for. Mm-hmm. And so he can't see he can't seem to move on because he can't get past what has happened. And, it leaves him stuck in a pattern where he can't really move out and find, let's say, a new love in his life.
Mm-hmm. But he's doing well in corporate America. Now, he's making money.
Well, they taught him well. They taught him well in the military on how to handle people and get what you want. Mm-hmm. So he uses that skill, that talent that he's learned, and he moves on and he does well out in the corporate world. But his personal life is still stuck, is still at the cemetery.
Okay. I've been wanting to ask you this question earlier. Do you know someone that can sing like Shirley Wilson?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Because you put it in the book, it's that the angels in heaven stand and smile when she sings. And I like, because when she finally realizes that she needs to move on from Malcolm, and I'm not going to give, you know, how she moves on, but she's able to sing again. And that was one of her passions.
Yeah. She loved singing. The people around her parents, the church, they loved hearing her sing. But because of the tragedy that befell her, she was stuck. But her singing, her voice, we've got a young lady at our church at the East St. Paul Baptist Church here in Fort Worth who could sing her ABCs.
Okay.
And make you shout.
I understand. How did you go about, obviously it's a good story, an interesting story, and as you just said, you just talked to your sister. I mean, once you start reading it, you want to, read it to the conclusion of making all these characters fit at the end. Because I'm quite sure it probably wasn't. I mean, you have the stories and you develop their background, but at the end, all of these individuals come together on one accord.
Well, I never took a journalism class.
Okay.
So when I sat down to write, I just asked God the same as I do when I'm working on a sermon. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Give me the words. Help me to write it the way you would have me to write it. Help me to do it the way you would have me to do it. And that's what I did. In my education, I did take some English classes.
Okay.
Because at one point I really thought I wanted to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. But all of that came in play to help me to be able to tie all this. And in fact, my background as an investigator with the DA's office, when we're putting cases together, we have to put all these loose ends together and come up with, it had to have happened this way so that we can find the outcome of how that situation really happened. So interviewing people over the years, and talking with them and finding out this person's story, this person's story, and seeing and bringing all that together. It helped me to be able to write this story.
Once one has read the book, what do you want them to come away with?
I'm hoping that they will see themselves in one of these characters, that they will see, and they'll be able to understand that we don't make all these decisions on our own.
We're not in control.
We're not in control. there's a high power. God Almighty is the one who's guiding our hands, who's leading us. Personally, I never liked Dallas, so I moved to Fort Worth. Now, it took about 5 years, but after I'd been over here for about 5 years and got my head on straight, I met my wife. So if I had never come to Fort Worth, I would have never met her, and I wouldn't be where I am today in a great loving marriage if I had moved to Fort Worth. So that was a reason.
Right.
He had me to move over here.
Over there.
And then the career that I've had. I think God places us where he wants us. When I had opportunities to go with Secret Service, the FBI, and all that, he told me to tell them no. And I thought, idiot, you have lost your mind. This is what you work for. But by being obedient to God's word, he has blessed me just tremendously.
How did you all come up with the cover? Because I mentioned it prior to this interview that I get books in the mail and you know, you open the package. But this particular, when I opened, you know, the package, you know, the cover just jumped out at me.
Well, the graphic artist is a guy named Torin Jesse. He's fantastic with what he does. And what he did was we looked at different, I told him what I thought I wanted. And he told me what he thought we needed to do. So we looked at different cover designs. And he said, wait a minute, I know what to do. He came up with the design that you're looking at. And I'm like, no, that's a little bit too strong. He said, well, number one, it's your history. You were in law enforcement for, you know, almost, you know, 40 years carrying a gun and a badge.
Cleveland Pimpton, author of No One Left to Hate. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, at KUT.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.